Everybody and welcome. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesday, May 26, 2021. And thank you for joining us for the 109th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you very much for that. And if you would not mind, please let us know the name of the song and the artist, and its relevance to tonight's topic.
So most people probably recognize that. And that was a song called Photograph, which appeared off the very first solo album from Ringo Starr, former Beatle drummer. And it was a song actually co-authored with George Harrison, who was obviously Ringo's former bandmate in the Beatles. And the reason I chose that song is because it's a song about memories. It's a song about wishing the lover was still there, and every time he sees her face, it reminds him of a place he used to go. Yeah. But all he has is a photograph, and he realizes she won't be coming back anymore. So I thought it was kind of a nice lead-in to what we're going to be talking about this evening.
Yes, that's fair. And as Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled Prolonged Grief Disorder, which we will discuss in a moment. So before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So I thought we would talk about a guitarist that most people know. He's a singer-songwriter, but predominantly a guitar player, even though he plays several different instruments. That people know, but they probably don't know they know, and that is a gentleman known as Dave Mason, who most people may know from the one solo song that he did that got very, very popular, We Just Disagree, which was actually not written by him. It was written by his guitarist in the band that he works with him a lot. But I know Dave Mason from his work with Traffic, which is one of my all-time favorite pop, rock, acoustic-y jazz kind of bands back in the 70s and late 60s and early and mid-70s. And most people know the song, but they don't know Dave Mason's the author or that it was first played by Traffic, which is the song Feeling All Right. I'm not feeling too good myself. And that's a song that's been covered by like every frickin' body on the planet. But that was originally recorded and written by Dave Mason with Traffic. Dave Mason was sort of an on-again, off-again member of Traffic. According to Steve Winwood in an interview, he just didn't quite fit in because everybody else and the other members of Traffic were Jim Capaldi on drums, who actually Dave Mason played with previously in a couple of bands prior to Traffic, and Chris Wood, who was the flautist and saxophonist and occasional bass player and occasional guitar player. They were all multi-instrumentalists in Traffic. But according to Steve Winwood, he said, you know, the other three members of Traffic would write together and do more like a band kind of thing, and Mason would come in with the song completely done up and said, okay, my tune, here's what you're going to play, here's what you're going to play, here's what you're going to do. And it just didn't really jive that well with the other folks. So he was kind of an on-again, off-again member. Regardless of that, they put out some really good songs, and he played with them on several of their records. Just really, I love that stuff. If folks aren't familiar with it, they should go back and check it out. But in addition to that and doing solo work on his own, which he is most often, folks who know him know me mostly for solo work, but he's played with everybody either live or on their records, everyone from Graham Nash and David Crosby, Michael Jackson, Eric Clapton, Mama Cass Elliott. He did a duo record with her back in the day. Leon Russell, Jimi Hendrix, Delaney and Bonnie, and he was one of the friends for Delaney and Bonnie while Clapton was with them, so he's obviously played with Clapton. George Harrison has done work solo outside of Traffic with Steve Winwood, Paul McCartney, Fleetwood Mac. I mean, he's played with a few people. And
gets around.
He gets around. A song he did not write. And it was actually when Traffic was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, he was inducted with him. I think that was in 2004. But most people don't know that when Hendrix played Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower, when he recorded that for the Electric Ladyland record that came out around 68, just prior to Hendrix's death, Dave Mason actually sang background vocals on Crosstown Traffic, and more importantly was the 12-string acoustic guitar intro to All Along the Watchtower. So that da-da-da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da, that's Dave Mason.
Oh.
So he's, yeah, He also played on one of my favorite Stones records, Beggar's Banquet, which also came out, I think, in 68. And on Street Fighting Man, he plays bass drum and plays the shanai, which is this kind of weird flutie-esque instrument. And you can hear it, particularly at the end of the recording of that, where you hear this little doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, and it sounds like a flute, but it's not really a flute. It's a shanai, and that's also Dave Mason playing that. So he gets around. He was played on some of the stuff off George Harrison's All Things Must Pass, which was his first solo recording prior Beatles, and also was supposed to be one of the second guitarists in Derek and Domino's, and actually played one gig with them but departed after that, and I don't know the particulars about that. He also has played off his bandmate Jim Capaldi's solo records, and they actually did a tour. I think it was in late 1990s, maybe 1998. They did a tour called the 40,000 Headmen Tour, and 40,000 Headmen is a very famous Traffic tune, one of my favorite tunes. And the two of them played together doing a bunch of Traffic stuff and some of the Dave Mason solo stuff, so it was kind of cool. All right, he's got just a number of solo records, both live and studio. He's done a couple of TV performances, and actually was supposed to tour on a one of the incarnations of Ringo Starr and his All-Star Band, and started playing, doing the rehearsals with them. But for some reason didn't make it. The rehearsal got canceled. I don't know what the heck happened. But anyway, he ended up not being on that tour. He also, for a very, very short period of time, I think in 95, was actually a member of Fleetwood Mac and didn't play very long with them, but played long enough with them to open for REO Speedwagon and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. So,
wow.
Yeah, this guy's gotten around. He has definitely gotten around. And he actually, there was a solo tour that Steve Cropper did, and most of folks know Steve Cropper probably as the guitarist of, in the band with the Blues Brothers, but Steve Cropper's real, in my opinion, claim to fame is him playing with doing the Green Onions, and I'm losing the name of the band right now. I'm having an anomia moment. Booker T and the MGs, along with his, he was the guitar player for them, along with his bass mate, Donald Duck Dunn, who most people also know, who's also played with Clapton. That really was his nickname. He's the guy on the bass. He also played bass guitar. He was the guy smoking the pipe on the Blues Brothers. That was Donald Duck Dunn. Yeah. Also, you know, and even though he was born in England, he emigrated permanently to the United States, I think in 91, and lives in California. But he's had homes, you know, in Hawaii, Nevada, the guy's got a lot of money from a lot of the royalties of the cool songs he's written. He's also known for his philanthropic activities. So he was at, in the 2000s, I think 2004, 2005, I can't remember, he was signed on as an official supporter of Little Kids Rock, which is a nonprofit organization that gives free musical instruments and lessons to kids in public schools. And he is an honorary board of director member, I think, to this day. He also is a founding board member of Yoga Blue, which teaches yoga and various holistic practices to persons suffering from substance abuse and addiction disorders. And also, he founded with one of his friends, I think Ted Knapp is his name. He's the one that founded Rock Our Vets, which is an organization that's also been signed on by a number of other musicians, including Joe Walsh and maybe John Bon Jovi. Don't quote me on that one, but I know Joe Walsh is part of this, that definitely supports veterans and their families and law enforcement folks and anybody basically who does high-risk stuff like veterans and law enforcement people and firefighters and EMTs and that sort of stuff, and provides food and clothing to them and computers to those who want to continue their education, as long as counseling for suicide prevention to those folks, so that when they do shows for them, they donate all the proceeds to help that organization. He's a founding member of that. So, He has definitely done more than just play music and write cool songs. So I want to do a shout out to him. He's still around and still playing. So woohoo to you. And at one point, I also got together with a guy, and I can't remember who the guy's name was. Oh, I do remember. Ravi Swani, and that really is his name, who started a guitar company. That's not like some made up like, oh, I'm going to be this Swami guy. He actually has this kind of promotional company and started a line of guitars. It didn't last very long, and I'm not quite sure why that was. But he had several people signed up and, you know, bought the guitars, and like famous artists, and I can't remember the names of any of them at the moment. But he actually had his own guitar company for a while. You know, he's definitely been around. So there you go. In a quick nutshell, the summary of Dave Mason, who is, as I said, still out there doing his thing.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that. Very interesting, as always. And we invite our listeners who might be interested in talking about that or anything else tonight, feel free to come into the online chat room anytime throughout the evening until around midnight, or feel free to give us a call, and we can do this on the phones. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. Okay, meat and potatoes time. It is the topic tonight, prolonged grief disorder. All right, so a couple of weeks ago, I stumbled across a posting, whoopsie, and Dr. Mathis got dropsy. All right, I stumbled across
the
posting on... Yeah,
the cap to my wiper for my guitar.
Posting on social media about grief, and there was quite an uproar in the comments below, and somebody had posted links to a couple of articles and was fussing that, quote, grief was in the DSM-5 as a pathology. And I had to go see what the heck that was about. So as with many mental health issues and conditions, there are often pop culture misinterpretations, misunderstandings, or a stigma behind the actual pathology or situation. So our goal tonight is to chase down this assertion that I saw and find out the facts about the matter and bring those facts to our listeners. So tonight we will discuss first the basic function or purpose of both the DSM-5 and the ICD-11 diagnostic reference books, the history, purpose, and facts of how grief became listed as a pathology, and I've said this in a way that's something of a misnomer, which we're going to talk about, and reviewing criteria so that our listeners can know when grieving has become a mental health issue that wants professional help. And before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything that you would like to add.
No, I'll save my comments for the meat and potatoes.
All righty. Well, that is just about shortly. So let's dive right in. So the first part is the basic function or purpose of both the DSM-5 and the ICD-11 diagnostic reference books. So in order to fully address the concerns of the evening, we want to first establish some known parameters to the topic. So the first most obvious one is explaining what are the DSM-5 and the ICD-11 and their purposes in mental health diagnostics. Some persons, upon hearing that, quote, grief is in the DSM, react negatively, implying a societal misunderstanding about the nature of mental health diagnoses and their implications about an individual's health, functionality, safety, trustworthiness, and similar concerns. The frequent reaction seems to be that if someone's condition is listed, that they're mentally ill and dangerous or otherwise messed up. So let's dispel this notion first. So I have a question for Dr. Mathis. I have a couple of them in a row, and they're a little bit on the long side, for which I apologize, but let's go ahead and put this on the table. So what, in your professional opinion, is the purpose of the DSM and the ICD? functionally, is it something like a dictionary is for our language? Is it correct to say that just like physical health diagnoses, it's important to have professional consensus as much as possible while science and medicine continue to evolve, doctors continue to learn, and the reference material is effectively a living document that shifts with the verification of new knowledge. That standardization of agreed-upon methods is important to ensure a patient receives consistent and vetted care as much as possible. And I'm going to turn that over to you for commentary.
Yeah, essentially that's true. It's not so much, it is sort of a dictionary, but what it really is the DSM is an American invention, so it's kind of a North American and to some degree in Canada use, but predominantly an American invention. The ICD is the international code, so most every other country on the planet historically has used the ICD as their reference. So think of these texts as descriptors of certain mental health syndromes, everything from addiction disorders to schizophrenia to conduct disorder to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder to whatever. So they are a way to concretize and come to a consensus based on research methods and statistical analyses of the prevalence in the population. Are certain disorders more common among males or females? Are they more common in certain ethnic or racial or national, international groups? It's a way for everybody to speak the same language when they describe something. So if one person says, oh, this looks like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, they don't have different criteria by which to judge that. So it's a norming of mental disorders, for lack of a better term, and for us to agree upon. But you're also right. It is in a sense, it is a living document, because as we learn new things and get more information that we didn't know before, as our methods improve and we get, you know, better techniques to look at things and we have a longer time to look at them, sometimes we label things, we define a syndrome and name it, and then we kind of go, oops, wait a minute, maybe that's something else. And a good example of that is schizophrenia, because initially it was thought of as some kind of childhood autism-y kind of whatevers, and people went, oh, wait a minute, it's this. So you don't know any of that stuff till you get more data and you look at more folks who suffer from it and you have a consensus of what's going on. Now, occasionally, at least in America, and I can't speak for the ICD, at least in DSM purposes, it has unfortunately become subject to a lot of social and economic pressure. So a lot of disorders have been renamed and or eliminated, frankly, because the insurance companies have put pressure on people because they don't want to pay for them. Or certain groups have felt offended at certain diagnoses, feeling that they overly pejoritize their racial group or sexual group or whatever, which I personally find very insulting and disgusting and have no use for it. Some of the folks who run the DSM have bowed to economic and social popular pressure to try to take certain disorders out of the DSM or rename them. And a great example of that is Asperger's, which in my mind is a very, very viable disorder. And they tried to put it under autism and make this autism spectrum thing, which I think is total horse manure. And so do a boatload of other clinicians. That's not just me being my usual weird critical self. They had hundreds of thousands of people who wrote in, clinicians who wrote in saying, don't even think about doing it. And they did it anyway. So there are certainly, it has become in more recent years more of a socially appropriate kind of document than it is a medical, psychological, scientifically vetted document. Although I would say the vast majority of it still is that. There are certain things that become hot topics. And because there are hot topics, certain people want to jump on the popular bandwagon and whatever. But in a nutshell, it's a way for folks to understand the same disorder means the same thing, whether it's in Russia or France or Greece or Israel or, you know, South Carolina or Ohio or Idaho or Vancouver, Canada.
Yeah. Okay. And that actually, the last stuff you brought up is exactly why I'm poking that bear tonight, because, you know, as a normal course of science and opinion, I know that there are differences between the DSM and the ICD, and that's understood and it's okay. But I also know that it has become inflamed in the last decade. And, you know, the Asperger's division is one of the big ones. And that's going to kind of color, consider that an open-ended question framing everything I'm poking tonight, because, you know, that's a great example of why we're not entirely sure and confident that these definitions are, quote, true or accurate or correct or whatever. It's why it's a living document, because this argument's not done. It's not even close.
Yeah, and so I don't know if you know it or not, and I don't know if I ever mentioned it to you, and I don't think I've ever mentioned it to the audience. They were, in this last iteration of the DSM-5, they were actually thinking about taking out borderline personality disorder, because a lot of the quote-unquote feminist groups bitched about it being pejorative. Well, it's not pejorative, it's reality, and it does happen more with women. But let me tell you, I've seen it with guys, and when guys get it, it's just as ugly. You know? And if you want to try to cry sexual bias, let me tell you, the vast majority of DSM and ICD disorders, when there is a gender discrepancy, us guys got it nailed. I mean, we are overrepresented in the mental health department when there is a gender discrepancy. In some cases, you know, 1,000 to 1, males to females with a disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. It be ugly. Right? So I my typical joke, even though it's not a joke, when I'm talking to groups in the community, as you know, I'll say to the, particularly if there's a lot of women in the crowd, I'll say, well, you know, when you guys said the source of your relationship issues was guys because they were like more FUBAR than women, guess what? You're right.
Right?
And they all start laughing. And the guys are giving me dirt, right? And the guys are giving me dirty looks. I'm like, no, get that smirk off your face, dude. I'm a guy too. It's sad but true, to quote Metallica. It is an absolute fact. It is not gender bias. It's reality. Okay, so get off your gender bias horse. There are just certain things that are more female than male, but they aren't many of them, let me tell you. You know, you just got to laugh at it, because, I mean, you know, if you look at it, things like conduct disorder and ADHD and antisocial personality disorder and all that kind of stuff, guys got it way over women. I mean, there's not even a contest. It's pretty sad, but it's the way it is. And for some of those, it's because, I suspect, of as one of my old girlfriends used to say, horny moans. I used to get a big kick out of that. And particularly the fact she was a biology major, which made it even funnier. Yeah. So, you know, it is what it is. But, yeah, but it is an ever-evolving piece of literature, in some cases evolving in my personal opinion, an appropriate way. In some cases, not so much.
Gotcha. Okay. So I feel better that at least I am perceiving that part correctly. So this
yes, ma'am.
Is good lead into the next part. The second question I have for you, and that's related, why is it helpful or necessary to make grieving a diagnosis? It's skipping ahead in our discussion a little bit to point out that simple grieving is not what is listed in either the DSM or the ICD. And so listeners should please be very clear that nobody is pathologizing grief as a reaction or as a practice. And we're going to talk specifically later in the show tonight about the process by which a specific extreme subset of grieving behaviors did come to be recorded in the DSM and ICD. So, you know, do you have an opinion on why we are putting grief in here at all?
Yeah, I think So I've seen a couple of examples. I haven't seen a lot, but I've seen a couple of examples of folks who experienced some kind of loss, whether it was a long-term relationship that ended or a favorite pet who died, or they got in a car wreck or some kind of accident and lost, you know, cognitive functioning or limbs or paralyzed or, you know, had a family member, divorce, you know, a nasty divorce, whatever. And, you know, 10, 12, 15 years later, they're still in the same emotional and cognitive mindset they were the first 6 months of the event. That's not a good thing. And that's not to say that you're going to forget about the loved one if it's a loved one that was lost, or you forget about a beloved animal that you had for 10 or 12 or 15 years. I mean, that's not rational either. But there's a level at which, you know, I saw a joke about this, this particular phrase I'm going to use, which I thought was pretty funny, which is, time wounds all heals.
Oh!
And isn't that great?
That joke. Here we go.
Isn't that great? And that's not even mine, because, you know, that sounds like something
great,
stupid I would
painful.
Say.
Painful. That's what you mean.
But, you know, over a certain period of time, folks need to readjust and to move on. And in my personal opinion, if you're going to honor, if it's a loss of a loved one or an animal or a relationship or whatever, you do that relationship a disservice, because I think if that person gave a flip about you at any point in his or her or whatever existence, which I'm sure that person did, or person or persons did, they would want you to grow and get better and move beyond the hurt and the pain and the loss. But that's not to say that occasionally you think about it and you feel a little sad, you feel a little reminiscent. Okay, it's when you're still not working, you're incapacitated, you're doing drugs to cover up the pain, whatever, you know, 8, 10, 12, 15 years later. That's the difference in what's known as, in my business, quote-unquote, pathological grieving versus what I call normal grieving. You know, you get in a car wreck and you lose functioning, or you lose an arm or you know, whatever. You know, your child is killed, or your mother or wife or husband or boyfriend or whatever. And you're not having an emotional reaction, there's something wrong with you. I mean, seriously. And you're losing, you know, you had a job and all of a sudden you got cut from your job, for, you know, and you've been a valued employee for, you know, 5, 10, whatever years. No, you have a right to be angry. You have a right to be, in my personal opinion, you have a right to be angry and you have a right to be grieving. And I think if you don't have those kinds of reactions, then, you know, I'm sort of like, okay, what's the problem here? What's wrong with you? Why aren't you upset? Why aren't you angry?
Why aren't you upset? Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, seriously. And so, you know, when somebody comes into my office, and I see this occasionally, somebody will lose a family member, and they're sad about it, but they're also really pissed off because they feel abandoned. And then they feel bad at themselves and angry at themselves for feeling angry at the person for dying. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. And so we have to work through that, because grief isn't a simple process. None of this stuff is simple, right? It's all kind of complicated. You know, it's like the old song in the 80s, the thin line between love and hate. And that's true.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's just you have a mix of emotions when you have a loss. And some of it's self-blaming, and some of it's other blaming, and some of it's sadness, and some of it's bitterness, and whatever. Those are all normal reactions, and they can last depending on the importance of the event and the significance of the event in your life. It can last, you know, the DSM used to talk about being 2 years as being a healthy grieving time, and then after that it became pathological. I don't necessarily subscribe to that. If you've had a relationship that you've been in for a long time, or you've had a pet for 10 or 12 or 15 years and you were very close to that pet and the pet dies, and 2 years comes and you're like, okay, I'm over it, I don't necessarily subscribe to that. I think that, you know, it can take up to 5 or 8 years or whatever. Now, you may not be in the same level of grief you were the first 6 months or 2 years or whatever, but, you know, if it's a really important thing, you're going to be grieving it I mean, I'll give you another really good example. You know, you have somebody who is in athletics, professional athletics, and they've now hit their early to mid-30s, and they can't do it anymore. That's retirement age for professional athletes, right? Or particularly for, you know, Olympic athlete levels, because you've got all these, you know,
you've got these young whippersnappers
that are displacing them. And they're pretty, you know, their entire identity is wrapped up in being this tennis star or this football hero or this basketball, whatever their thing is, right? That's pretty goddamn problematic and stressful. I mean, in the music world, you know, you have a guy who all of a sudden develops, has a stroke and can't play music anymore, right? Or develops a amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and there's actually a case of that. And you can't play guitar anymore. You can't play bass or keyboards. You can't sing. You can't remember. You know, that's pretty goddamn traumatic, particularly if that's your livelihood and that's your only way of making money, and or if that's become your, you know, part of your existential identity and you were a famous musician and you can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
That's pretty goddamn traumatic. You're going to be grieving over that. You would not be human if you weren't doing that. So, you know, how long are you going to grieve for? I don't know. You know, I don't think you can pull out a ruler and go, oh, on the grieferometer, you know, on the Richter scale of grief, this is a 3.7. You know, it's like I tell people that I see who are what I call faux devout Christians, and I'm not slamming devout Christians, I'm slamming faux devout Christians, you know, who want to pull out what I call a sinometer. And go, whoop, you lied, that's a sin. Whoop, you had sex out of marriage, that's a sin. Whoop, you killed somebody, that's a sin. Well, that's a worse sin than that. You know, there's no place that I'm aware of in the Quran or the Torah or the Bible that has a little scale you measure. A sin is a sin, end of story. There's no measurement here, right? Well, grief and grief and grief are not all grief, because everybody's different and everybody assigns different valences, values, to the loss and the incident that they lose. And that's why you see some people have these things happen to them and they're like, I'll get over it. Or, I can compensate. And you get some people who are just blown away. And so part of the grief reaction also has to do with internal resources that we have or not. And how many of them do we have? How resilient are we? We've talked about that before. Now, resilience plays a factor in here. But you know what? I don't care how resilient you are. Everyone has a breaking point. Everyone has a point where you fill the glass too full and the water, you know, spills over. So I think it's kind of presumptuous for any of us to say, you know, okay, this is over. 2 years you're done. 3 years you're done. You know, I always weigh how I judge the grief reaction to the level of incident and the meaning it has in my client's life. Because, you know, I'm not God. I can't, you know, I don't have this magic formula.
Okay. All right, let's go ahead and continue. Okay, so the first part, you know, I just kind of wanted to establish this is what these books are for. Because a lot of people are like, oh, my God, I'm in the book, therefore I am bad and wrong and broken, and I'm bringing these points up and verifying with you to establish for them this is not cause for freak out.
Yep.
So we would like to also establish that it's normal for science to be malleable and still be empirical and factual. New ideas and discoveries happen. We talked a little bit about this just a little while ago. Old data gets reinterpreted in a better way. New examples and new evidence are discovered. Scientific fact is fact, as much as anything can ever be known, in that time and place with the relevant data that's available. So it does not make facts or science spurious if a change or adjustment is made that considers new information. And I bring that up because the whole complex, prolonged grief disorder thing, this is all definitely within the last decade, you know, and there's a little history before that, but the main part is recently. This is a recent change. A lot of people are flipping out because articles have come out that said, oh, we already did this. We just didn't tell you yet. That's what the freak out is. And so I'm trying to get you guys to understand, you know, science is still factual just because it's a living document. That doesn't make it not fact. It just means new data happens, and so it gets included. And it's done without bias and agenda if you're doing it scientifically. So this is not cause for freak out. This kind of thing is precisely what happened with newer mental health interpretations of grief. So in a few moments, we'll discuss the history of this condition and the reasoning and parameters of recent changes to both reference books. And lastly, I want to dispel the notion that seems to lie unconsciously behind frequent societal reactions to grieving, whether it's healthy grieving or something more pathologically disruptive. We as a culture have a twisted relationship with death, dying, grieving, and loss. In some parts of our country to this very day, you know, regional culture, it's considered in bad taste to even speak of it beyond brief hushed whispers in private. Oh my God, so-and-so died. You know, you get that kind of crap going on. So to be clear, grief in and of itself is not abnormal. It's not unhealthy. It's not a source of shame. And regardless, even if it was, having a diagnosable condition does not make someone bad, wrong, or a lesser person unworthy of respect. So we need to get a grip on these reactions that we have as a society. And diagnoses are the first step to rendering treatment and aid. And here I'm going to pause and check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything else before we move on.
Yeah, I apologize for my lengthy diatribe earlier, but I wanted to really make it clear to folks what was going on. And one other thing I would say is, you know, if you think you have an issue with this kind of stuff, you know, maybe going in and seeing somebody will dispel the myth that you're broken, that, you know, maybe it can be reassuring, like, oh, wait a minute, I'm not broken. This is a normal reaction.
Yes. Yeah, and that's a valid use of mental health assistance. Is
absolutely.
Maybe just to validate that, no, what you're going through is neurotypical. You're not messed up. You're not dangerous. You're not on the edge. All this stuff that people are terrified of. You know, it's in the DSM. My life is over. In fact, I think I mentioned somewhere on my notes for the show something to the effect that I'm hard-pressed to think of just about anybody who doesn't have something. And it's very rare to find somebody who doesn't have a pathology at all. That's actually a little odd. It's, you know, but it's not common.
I call that the Rosanna Dana syndrome. It's always something.
That's cute.
Yeah, well, that Saturday Night Live stuff. Oh, my boy, that was genius.
That was good.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go ahead and get to the second part. I'm hearing me in the background, if you're able to tweak that just a tiny bit. Okay, so section two.
Thank you.
Is the history, purpose, and facts of how grief became listed as a pathology. So first, to our listeners, I apologize because that section title is avoidably inflammatory, and I chose to leave it this way as a means of segueing into the next section. So grief itself is not what's listed. Get very clear on that. It's not grief any more than a few bad days is listed as anxiety or depression. It's a subset of grieving behavior that is part of the diagnosis in question. So let's talk about how this came to pass, and it should hopefully make more sense and reassure our listeners that the ritual of grief is not under attack from mental health professionals. So where it all began, and my main source for this was the European Journal of Psychotraumatology. So this is a little bit of crunchy history about it, and I actually wrote down notes, and then there were so many notes I stopped because I don't want to drown you guys. There's a lot here. To be honest with you, if it's okay with you, Dr. Mathis, I think it's fair for me to kind of summarize, because I got three giant paragraphs of history on this. And the long and the short of it, it goes back to the 90s. People were doing the research that's eventually going to end up and just in the last decade, validating the concept of complex PTSD. That has not always been part of it. That's a somewhat recent decision. And in the research and the tightening up of those definitions with PTSD, it was discovered that grief can be a form of trauma because, the loss is so great, the reaction is so great, and these things are related items. And out of that research started to come the research that led to this. And I believe it started in the mid-2000s where it started going off on this specific path. And guys, understand I'm summarizing like three huge paragraphs of crunchy things. I have all the receipts, but what we don't have is a lot of time. So I am taking some liberties to summarize here.
Yeah, sure.
So we go through, and actually I full-on said when we got to about 2016 or 17, in order to keep this show from becoming a two- or three-parter, suffice to say that the number of factors used in diagnoses in this area became somewhat unwieldy while they were poking it. And the priority became standardizing the criteria in a way that was manageable and usable in the field. Because a lot, especially when in the ICD, the WHO's priority was that a lot of people who had traumas were like the big thing once CPTSD became known. And so their priority was, we got a lot of people who are displaced by war or poverty or, you know, other country fighting, other things going on. Maybe the United States doesn't deal with as often. So they wanted to be able to deal with these people out in the field, in the wild, and the ICD is what the WHO is using to do that. So they wanted to basically make this simple because right now it's spaghetti, and that's what happened. So essentially, I'll read you the last part, the last paragraph of that whole chunk. As PGD, which is prolonged grief disorder, and this is the current terminology, there have been several others. For example, persistent complex bereavement disorder. There was some linguistic fighting in the late 20-teens. So just to let you guys know, these are all the same thing. The terminology bounced around as they kept redefining it. So as PGD is a newly refined diagnostic category, ultimately clinic-based field tests and epidemiological studies are required to confirm its clinical utility. In other words, you know, usefulness in diagnosing things. There are still significant questions concerning the application of this definition to different cultural groups and across the lifespan. In other words, like, you know, say if you are in your 80s and you're losing a life partner, that's something that's kind of expected, and it's a little different than you're 25 and you were married 2 years and your partner is killed. You know, it's a different kind of grief. So there's a lot of things that they're still tweaking. And to date, the WHO, World Health Organization, the UN, framework of clinical utility and international applicability has contributed to the development of applicable and culturally informed diagnostic criteria for PGD that it is hoped will improve clinical practice. In other words, like I said earlier, it's a living document. Science is still poking itself, and that's how it's supposed to work. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the definition. This is how science has always worked. In the proposal for the 11th edition of the ICD, disorders specifically associated with stress have been a topic of great interest for researchers and clinicians, particularly the categories of post-traumatic stress disorder I mentioned earlier and CPTSD. Until recently, researchers and clinicians have used different diagnostic criteria and different assessment measures for disordered grief, as the previous diagnostic criteria for PGD had not been established and recognized yet. The basic summary is that only a subset of grief behavior characterized by long-term life-disrupting behaviors, very similar to CPTSD as opposed to traditional, original PTSD, were targeted in the newer definitions. And so, you know, it's subjective, but it's a matter of extremes here, to be really clear about it. So this is notes on current form of diagnosis that they have. This is the official diagnostic criteria. My source for this is Complicated Grief at columbia.edu. The most recent versions of standard official diagnostic guidelines include a diagnosis of prolonged grief disorder in both the DSM-5 and ICD-11. This is a condition that we have been calling complicated grief. Same thing. Notes on the ICD version. In 2018, the WHO approved a new diagnosis of prolonged grief disorder. Guidelines for this diagnosis include the occurrence of a persistent and pervasive grief response characterized by longing for the deceased. And I'm going to tell you right now, this definition sounds like it could be misinterpreted sometimes. It's very subjective right now, which is why it's still malleable. So, you know, when I read this to you, understand that I'm aware how that sounds, and that's what we're poking. So the deceased or persistent preoccupation with the deceased accompanied by intense emotional pain, sadness, guilt, anger, denial, blame, difficulty accepting the death, feeling one has lost a part of oneself, an inability to experience positive mood, emotional numbness, difficulty in engaging with social or other activities, that sort of thing. You can find the full guideline online. The number that they give it, ICD has numbers, the DSM does not. So 6B42, prolonged grief disorder in the ICD. The grief response has persisted for an atypically long period of time following the loss. They say more than 6 months at a minimum. Dr. Mathis and I have both poked that, where that consider that number super flexible and subjective, and clearly exceeds expected social, cultural, or religious norms for the individual's culture and context. Grief reactions that have persisted for longer periods that are within a normative period of grieving, given the person's cultural and religious context, are viewed as normal bereavement responses, and I'm very happy to hear them specify this, and are not assigned a diagnosis. The disturbance causes significant impairment in personal, family, social, educational, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. And in other words, the ICD seems to factor in context and culture and other subjective mitigating factors, and that is crucial for this. Dr. Mathis, do you want to jump in and say anything? I've gone on for a while without checking in with you, and I didn't know if you wanted to comment on these one at a time.
No, I'm okay, thanks.
Okay, just checking. All right, so the DSM-5 version, similar situation. And just in 2020, the APA, American Psychiatric Association, approved a new diagnosis of prolonged grief disorder. So they got on the boat second. The official announcement is pending. That was what the article was that started the kerfuffle. The criteria for this disorder are more specific. However, our data and that of others confirm that they harmonize well. In other words, what they're saying is very similar to what the ICD is saying. That isn't always the case. In fact, both of them contain data that the other one doesn't sometimes. This is not one of those times. So DSM-5 PGD requires the occurrence of a persistent and pervasive grief response characterized by persistent longing or yearning and or preoccupation with the deceased, accompanied by at least three of a list of eight additional symptoms that include disbelief, intense emotional pain, feeling of identity confusion, avoidance of reminders of the loss, feeling of numbness, intense loneliness, meaninglessness, or difficulty engaging in ongoing life. Differential diagnosis, and if you guys remember, that's essentially stuff that can get confused with other stuff and you need a professional to figure out which one it is. That's kind of a layperson's deep and dirty version of what that means. Dr. Mathis,
AKA don't try this at home. These are professionals.
Yes. Do not try this in your own living room. So PGD is most often confused with depression. There is solid evidence that treatment for depression is far less helpful than targeted grief treatment. So this difference is important. Core symptoms of PGD are persistent yearning and preoccupation with the deceased, whereas core symptoms of depression are pervasive, free-floating sadness and loss of interest and pleasure. These differences can help you distinguish grief from depression. And I have another question for Dr. Mathis here. What tools would mental health professionals use, especially grief counselors and other specialists, to differentiate the subjective lines between understandable grief and self-destructive or dysfunctional grieving?
Okay, that's a good question. Part of it is going to rely on your clinical interviewing skills and asking the right questions during the diagnostic interview and making sure that you're listening carefully and hitting all the areas. The other thing is that there are numerous implements to measure anxiety versus depression so that you could rule some of those out or rule some of those in as co-occurring disorders along with the grief stuff and measures for PTSD. That's part of the reason that when somebody walks in the door, and you know, here we go again, that everybody walks in the door gets an MMPI because it's really good at looking at depression versus PTSD versus anxiety and how those things are being manifested. And when you combine that with the two-hour intake I do, it's going to be pretty easy to determine, you know, which one of these versions we have, and do we have all of them? Do we have two of them? Do we just have one of them? And those are all real important because, you know, most of the folks that I see have a lot of DSM stuff going on, and it's real important for me to know how much of what's contributing to the picture so that I can try to pick a therapeutic intervention that's going to get as much bang for my buck as possible and hit as many of the symptomatology and disorder stuff as possible so the person can get relief quicker.
Yeah. Okay. Is there anything else that you want to touch on before we go to the last part here?
No, I'm good. Thanks.
Okay. So the last thing I want to talk about real quick, and we can probably squeeze this in just going over time a wee bit here, is reviewing criteria so that our listeners can know when grieving has become a mental health issue that wants professional help. And again, I'm going to say this 100 times because people are already misunderstanding the articles. We're not saying that grief and grieving in itself is a mental illness. And we're not really even backing some of the standardized criteria that says, you know, how long before it is. It's real subjective. It's culture contingent. It's context contingent. And, you know, you really need somebody to sit and listen to where someone is. Now, there are moments where it is a problem, but just be really clear, it's not all a problem. So this last part is, you know, laugh at me. The source for this is a vetted Norwegian psych journal, but I can't spell it. So I can't
pronounce it.
Yeah, no. None of these things, but they did,
and that
they
would
did
make
have
two
this
of
information
us.
In English. Yep. So this is what they said. While many laypersons and professionals would say that normal grief lasts through the first year until all major anniversaries have passed, and I can see the wisdom in that, the proposal in ICD-11 states that prolonged grief can be diagnosed 6 months after the bereavement. And all of us tonight have said, well, maybe, but we think it could be longer and not be weird. So
yeah,
we're kind of giving that one the side eye.
Yeah, that gets my vote.
Yes, me too. You know, going through it right now and having just passed my year anniversaries of everything, I definitely vote for longer. The intensity and duration of the grief reactions must go beyond what is expected in light of cultural and religious norms. And again, cannot say this enough. This has to enter into it, and it's really huge. Studies indicate that approximately 7% of those who lose someone to death are affected by prolonged grief, but far higher figures have been found among parents who have lost a child and those who have been bereaved through sudden violent death, you know, like a car accident or Katrina or, you know, war or something like that. So it's important to point out that grief can be intense and last for more than 6 months without automatically being deemed abnormal. The central issue in prolonged grief is its considerable impact on daily functioning. Prolonged grief disorder versus depression. We talked about this a little bit a few minutes ago. This is an important way for you to know. A key assessment to distinguish prolonged grief from depression involves whether the thoughts and emotions continue to circle around the deceased, which is usually indicative of prolonged grief, or whether these are more free-floating and generalized and less associated with the loss itself. And that probably points to depression.
Mm-hmm.
For example, a low mood, dysphoria, in prolonged grief will be associated with the separation from the deceased, while depression will involve a more persistent and pervasive dysphoria, often in combination with pessimistic rumination and a general sense of hopelessness. These two conditions also differ in terms of avoidance behavior. While persons with prolonged grief will often tend to avoid specific places, things, and activities that remind them of the reality of the loss, people with depression will often engage in more general avoidance behavior and social withdrawal. And a quick note on diagnosis and treatment. Some screening tools are available. For example, the Inventory of Complicated Grief and Prolonged Grief Disorder, -13. I don't know what happened to the other 12, and I'm just being cute, but I don't seriously know. But beyond the criteria have not been finally defined in ICD-11, no single questionnaire is yet available to establish whether a person's struggling with prolonged grief. However, extensive research is still being undertaken in this area. And last question for Dr. Mathis, how would you advise any listeners that might be grieving a loss as how to know when they may be in prolonged grief and in need of professional help?
I would say that the easiest way to do that is to, you know, take a quick self-assessment. You know, what's the impact of the grief on your life? If it's a loss of a person or pet or friend, you know, family member, whatever, ask yourself how long you knew them, what role did the person play in your life or animal or whatever. If it's a loss of a functioning, you know, brain functioning, limb, whatever, ask yourself how important that is to you and how long have you used it. You know, there's all these other factors. And if you're just going, you know what, I have no clue, call somebody who's a professional in the area and just go in for one session, because the worst that'll happen is they'll tell you, you know, this is really normal and I would be surprised if you weren't experiencing that. Or they'll say, you know, I'm glad you came in today because, you know, you might have an issue with this. Let's explore some of this. That's the easiest way to find out. And then you don't have to
worry. Okay. All right, that's fair. That's absolutely fair. Is there anything else that you want to bring up about this section before we wrap up here?
No, I would say that your grief versus depression is really a good comparison. And what I would say is, think of depression as sort of the, you know, equal opportunity couch potato phenomena. You know, depression robs you of energy. You don't have energy to do dog squat, and it's everywhere, and it involves everything. Grief is much more situational, person or scenario focused, and while it may and often does come with an overlay of dysthymic disorder, which is now called persistent depressive disorder, or major depression, it's a separate entity, right? So depression is, as you pointed out, much more pervasive and generalized. Grief is much more situation-specific and person-specific or whatever-specific. Depression is much more generalized, and you'll see it everywhere. You won't just see it with a particular situation. Occasionally, people, for example, who have grief disorders, you can sometimes sideswipe them in a sense. You can kind of take them and go, hey, you know, why don't we go out for coffee or whatever? And if it's a person that's important in their life, they may actually entertain going out with this person that's kind of a break from their rumination. People who have depression typically won't do that. They'll just kind of go, nope, I'm not in the mood, don't have the energy. They'll make some, you know, excuse for begging off, but that's not usually the case with grief folks. So that's the little things like that.
Gotcha. Okay, that is very helpful. And there is one thing that's occurred to me that's not in my notes that I think it's important to say to our listeners. It's very critical that you guys understand whether it's depression or healthy, understandable grief or prolonged grief disorder, whichever one it is, understand and remember that being in quarantine for the last year and a half is going to make all of this kind of renegotiated, because we've kind of all been a little bit depressed and sequestered and can't do stuff, like everyone's going through it. And our support systems are all blown up and the whole thing. So what's normal and what's subjectively healthy or any of this stuff, it all got blown up. So be kind to yourselves and remember this. This is an extreme situation on top of a pathologically extreme situation. So don't be so mean to yourselves. Just get some help. Don't stigmatize it. Don't pick on people. Don't shame them. Don't freak out if you're in the DSM. Just calm down. It's all cool. We're all walking each other home. It'll be okay.
The other thing quickly wanted to say is there's also a difference between sadness and depression.
Yes, also true.
So, I'm just saying, if you think you got it, go see somebody and do yourself a favor, because if you do, you can get help. And if you don't, that's one less thing you got to worry about. Right.
Oh, you don't know how funny that is. It's actually a lyric from the musical Hamilton that's very popular right now.
Oh, that's so interesting. I did not know that.
So you're not musicals guy. Yeah, you're classic rock guy. I'm musicals guy.
Oh, there you go.
All righty. So, and with that, we're not too badly over time, so that's fine. In summary, we hope that our listeners can now better understand prolonged grief disorder and the bigger fluffle in the DSM and the ICD. So grief is a universal experience, and it's a common cultural ritual. And like many stages of life, pathology is measured more by disruption of a healthy and satisfied daily life. So hopefully this information can help our listeners to navigate healthy grief boundaries in their own lives. And this concludes our show on prolonged grief disorder. Is there anything else that you would like to say on this before we close up, Dr. Mathis?
I'm good, thank you.
All right. Well, you're not always good.
Ba-dum.
So, okay. Yeah, ba-dum-dum. All right, so on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and his puns, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who might be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks. Now Dr. Mathis is back from his break, so we'll be back on our regular schedule. And we'll have a new topic for you guys on Wednesday, June 9th, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. Real quick, I'd like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows that are coming up within the next couple of weeks. First one, tomorrow night, Travel Itch Radio, Thursday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, hosted by Dan Schlossberg, founder, host, and executive producer of Travel Itch Radio, and his co-host, Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee, Dan's longtime friend and colleague. Travel Itch Radio comes to Quebec City on Thursday, May 27th, when Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee host Robert Mercure, General Manager of Quebec City Tourism. Listen live at 8 p.m. New York time on iTunes or blogtalkradio.com as he outlines the rich historic legacy, explains everything from the ramparts to the funicular, and details the topography from the riverfront to the cobblestone streets to the top of the imposing Frontenac Hotel. Hear about 400 years of history made in this magnificent French-speaking community, and especially the impact of tourism in the 21st century. Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday morning extravaganza, 9 a.m. Eastern Time every Saturday. And the Monday morning quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning, and I'm not going to tell you the scary rest of that. You guys have heard it. Okay, Sunday, the 30th, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, Fear the Walking Dead online viewing party is back, with Season 6, Episode 15, USS Pennsylvania, airing on AMC. Please join us online or on the air by phone for real-time discussions, updates, trivia, profiles on the cast and crew, and more. The following Sunday, June 6th, will be Season 6, Episode 16, The Beginning, which is the end, meaning it's the season finale. So feel free to join us then. Monday, 10 p.m., Monday Night in America, Roger De Noriega brings you his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. The Nightmare Hunter with Roger Noriega has moved to Tuesday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Streamlabs. Tuesday, Fandom Access Week in Review here on Blog Talk Radio. Tuesdays, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, join the TV tantrum of Jamie, Karen, and AJ as they digest another night of TV. So please look for The Rock and Roll Shrink on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and on the web at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us, and rock on. See you next time.